Pope dies yet again. Reign is briefest ever. Cardinals return from airport. The other was Abby Hoffman, whom I'd gotten to know, though I can't remember how, when he was on the lam from the FBI and living in the Thousand Islands as Barry Freed. It was Barry, not Abby, who, when we went up to the islands, tried strenuously to seduce Carla, believing her to be Jewish and far too good for a goy like me. The old lefties met the very Republican mayor of our township, a silver-haired and bearded 300-pound ex-U.S. Army colonel, given to quoting Aristotle in township meetings. He married us with quiet eloquence. One of my best friends from the Lampoon, playwright John Wideman, was my best man. Carla's father read Gerard Manley Hopkins' Epithalamion in an intense, lyrical Pittsburgh accent. In every way, it was a gloriously American afternoon, the day I married my American wife, and she was breathtakingly beautiful. We traveled to England for our honeymoon, the first time I'd set foot in the country since Spitting Image. My little sister gave us a second wedding party at her 16th-century farmhouse in Derbyshire. And so to the tiny Piemontese hill town of Perosa, where we nailed the Italian part of the deal by spending a week with my new mother-in-law's family. The current nonno and nonna of the clan were the most hospitable people we'd ever met. We were family, so they had to give us their finest room, quella colletto matrimoniale. When we woke the first morning, it was to hear the pigs who lived in the sty below awakening to their breakfast. I thought I'd never been so happy. No sooner had we returned than the fighting resumed. We held nothing back, now that we'd tied the knot for the rest of our lives. The worst came on Christmas Eve, with the two of us stalking each other through the house, screaming uncontrollably. Later she cried uncontrollably. For the first time I noticed that her nose was rather larger than I'd thought. Friends helped us patch things up, and we vowed to do better. We stumbled through 1987. I got very busy finishing and publishing my book, and staffing a ghastly CBS morning show starring Mariette Hartley. She seemed smart and charming when she interviewed me, but on air turned out to have a limited supply of marbles. The other regular, Bob Saget, and I got through the ordeal by becoming good friends. Between ourselves, we called the show Diary of a Mad Housewife. Spinal Tap had now become a solid video hit. For the first time in my life, I was recognized regularly in public. Work flowed like cheap wine. Busy was good, but not very deep down, I had a feeling that history was repeating itself. For the second time, I could not help thinking, I've made the mistake of getting married to save a relationship. Or more accurately, getting married because I couldn't think of where else the relationship could go if it wasn't going to end. There's a second, related mistake people who've made the first often proceed to. Having kids to save the marriage that saved the relationship. Which we now did. For me, it wasn't the first time either. As the end of my first marriage had neared, Judy and I experienced a rush of regret and resolved to salvage something before it was too late. We had decided to try for another baby. The mission warmed things between us. She was almost 40, but she happened to be working on a book with an East Side OBGYN to the rich and brainless. This twerp assured her she'd be fine. She wasn't. She became pregnant, and not long afterward went through a life-threatening ectopic pregnancy. I came home one evening to find her gone from the house. It got later and later, but we were in the habit of leaving one another to each other's devices, and I assumed she was busy working with her author. Finally, the doctor's office called. I found out she was in the hospital and why. I was at first desperately disappointed. Then, to my horror, relieved. The OBGYN gave me little idea how serious the situation had been. She would be fine and home in a day or so. Since I have a near psychotic terror of hospitals, I didn't go visit her that night. For that, she never forgave me. Here I was a few years later, not learning from history, doomed to relive it. As before, resolving to have a baby had a calming effect. In due course, a period was missed and a pregnancy confirmed. Christmas of 87, our fifth together, was as quiet and sweet as any I could remember. Carla and I began to talk of the son who was coming, the little golden boy grinning up at us, running through the garden and along the trout stream just a couple of summers from now, holding us together in renewed love. Very early, one rainy Sunday in January, she woke bleeding, in terrible pain. All I could think as I helped her to the car was, "This can't be happening again." And again, too, that wicked little spike of relief. I hit 90, tearing to the nearest medical center, down our local state highway, a two-lane killer that had the highest fatality rate in the Northeast. I flashed my brights, blared my horn, crossed the double yellow line at will, Carla curled beside me in a fetal crouch of pain. I didn't really care if we head-on with someone. It didn't matter. There was no baby. There was no marriage. They rushed Carla into emergency and did what they do. At least it wasn't life-threatening. Soon she was comfortable, though lost and distraught. The nurse who'd attended her said the baby had been about 3 months old. She couldn't really tell at that age, but she thought it was a boy. Chapter 16. Cor was changing. On my first walk down through the grove of chestnuts, mature trees by now, to the little promontory overlooking the Solent, where I'd once seen Father Joe's knobbly knees, I came upon a monk I didn't recognize. He was standing with his back to me on the promontory's edge, the wind whipping his skirts, loading a handgun. His body language didn't suggest he was about to end his life, so I stepped behind an evergreen bush to see what the firepower was for. He cocked the gun and peered out over the breakers. A lone seagull cruised into view, tacking against the gusts, looking for its lunch. The monk took careful aim at it, fired, and missed. Shit! He shook his cropped head in disgust. He recocked the gun and fired again, the gun making a pop like a silencer. This time it hit the bird, and it fell into the surf, flapping wildly in its death throes. Gotcha, you bastard! His accent sounded South African, instantly evoking the odious Blair. I tried hard to flood my heart with charity. Hopeless. I hated him. Maybe he sensed this. When I greeted him, he turned without counter-greeting. See that? I got the bastard. But why? Hate the bastards. Not South African, after all. British, back from some Commonwealth outpost. Mea culpa. He seemed to think a layman might need an explanation for the gat. He waggled it in my direction, his finger still on the trigger. When you enter the monastery, they let you keep one thing. Oh, I see. As far as I could remember, sidearms were not mentioned in St. Benedict's rule. But the shooter had lost interest in me. Another victim had appeared, checking the lunch menu. When I mentioned the matter to Father Joe, he looked uncharacteristically judgmental, and pursed his long, untidy lips. There was more than a hint of Mary Poppins. I'm sure God has some purpose in mind, dear. After we lost the baby, Carla and I stopped fighting. At first, that seemed a good thing, whether it was out of respect for the dead, or a mutual understanding that what we fought about was always trivial, and losing a baby was not trivial. There was emptiness, too, which for a while also seemed natural and good, an intrinsic part of mourning. A little dark void where there had been a little glow of promise. But as the silence and the emptiness continued, another conclusion started pecking at my brain. There were no more fights because we had nothing left to say to each other. Fighting was one of the ways we connected. The clue was that rank though the fights could get, they were never terminal. Sometimes they were even foreplay to great tenderness or wild activity. They were a bruising way to let the pent-up frustrations of our relationship release themselves and fly away. A regular cold shower of secret truths about the other, which piled up inside each of us until the pressure got too great. Other couples had other ways of releasing them, teasing or venting to shrinks or harassing their kids. Fighting was ours. No harm done. But now, nothing. Was it the baby's death that had stopped us from fighting? Or was it that we'd arrived at a point where the only utility we had for each other was to collaborate on the making of a child? And that once that proved impossible, there was nothing further to be done or said or fought about? Once this thought entered my mind, though it was quite evident where it led, and I was not ready to look down that path, it would not go away. With it came another, even more poisonous thought, seeping through me like the lethal chemicals spreading through a condemned man's body. Punishment. I believed in no agency capable of inflicting so intangible a punishment. Years of watching others commit moral mayhem, at least as bad as mine, and get rewarded with only more and greater success, had convinced me of that. There was no retribution for anything, outside of felony one in front of witnesses. Yet on the old principle that he who knows the sin is the greater sinner, I couldn't quell a fear that this death in some higher court might be infanticide. Had that tiny scrap of stillborn innocence, bearing within him the seeds of self, been denied his shot by virtue of my vices, aborted by 30 years of selfishness and apostasy? We lived high. Illegal substances had traveled through various bodily passages. A lake of legal ones had gone much the same way. It made no difference whether you chose the medical or the religious approach. They were just different routes to the same destination. Fault. Was it my fault? Was it our fault? In the old days of our relationship, these weapons of mass destruction could never have been contained. They would have exploded into the mother of all battles. And yet, still, nothing. The two of us went about our business, sharing few words and fewer actions. We were even courteous to each other, a terrible sign. Politeness rang deafening alarm bells in my marital memory bank. With Carla, there had been great love. But something else had always lain beside our love, plotting its murder. We had never been able to get rid of our unwanted partner, our Iago, our unholy spirit. The conflicted, sinning Catholic writer and his beautiful, dark-haired American lover had reached the end of their affair. I began to feel the tug of core as never before. Not the customary run to Father Joe in a crisis, either. There was something much more elemental about the impulse this time. Something irresistible. When I came up the driveway, gray with jet lag, the great looming evergreens dripping with winter rain, the monastery looking shabbier and less inviting than I could ever remember it, one thought came into my head and kept running through it, in time with my sloshing feet. Home. Home. Now you are home. Home. I want my faith back, Father Joe.
I can't give you that, dear. But the fact that you are here seeking faith is itself an act of faith.
Why can't I believe even that? Why can't I believe in something? I'm so tired of believing in nothing.
Would you like to try going to confession?
Weird. I was thinking about that on the plane. I have plenty to confess. But honestly, I didn't know if you guys still had confession.
We guys do. These days it's called the Sacrament of Reconciliation. There's less call for it, I find.
We were in my room in the guest house. I hadn't stayed in the guest house for decades. Utterly unchanged it was. The same drab paint along the corridors, the same worn carpets and rickety armoires, the same smell of piety in the halls. home. He sat. I went to kneel, forgetting his preference. He gestured me up and into another chair, and took my hand and placed it on the arm of his, and put his big warm hand on mine. Utterly unchanged. His face still moved in the same patterns, twitching and screwing itself up to gather the energies within, but more slowly than of yore. He was 79, and had just gone a few rounds with prostate cancer. Not one of nature's athletes, always frail, he looked little the worse for wear. Apparently he was in total remission, the cancer having recognized a life force when it saw one.
"Now, dear, how long is it since your last confession?"
28 years.
And what would you like to confess?"
I'd thought about this a lot. I hadn't been able to go to sleep on the plane thinking about it. I'd thought about it for the last 2 days. Now my mind was blank. "I've been drunk many times and done a lot of drugs. Had sex with many women, some pretty weird things there. Do you want to hear the details?"
"No, I'll imagine."
"Okay, I've committed many acts of blasphemy, written many things that hurt people, haven't always worked, as you said, unselfishly and thankfully, pride, pretty bad pride, gluttony, anger, rage, lots of that. Did I say blasphemy?" He squeezed my hand gently to stop me.
"That's very good, Tony, dear. I know you're out of practice. Have you hurt anyone? Have you taken anything of value from anyone? Have you committed any crimes?"
"All of those things, Father Joe. I think I killed our baby. Carla and I were trying to have a baby, and we lost it. I'm sure it was the drink and the drugs and just the sheer unending malice inside me."
"Alas, women lose babies all the time, dear."
"But it's not the women. It's not the first time. I did the same to Judy with another baby. He died too. Two deaths, Father. I'm the common factor."
You're too harsh on yourself, dear. You always have been. It's not a virtue."
"Wait till you hear this. Both times, when I heard the baby was dead, I was happy."
"I can't believe that. I so wanted a little boy. I still do. I dream about it. And then, when the little boys die, all I feel is relief. What kind of person have I become, Joe? I was going to be a saint once."
He checked some incoming messages, eyes still closed.
These are great imperfections, dear. But they're not what you really want to say, are they?"
He was right. He was listening, but I was not. There was something, but I couldn't quite reach down far enough to find it.
Say what's in your heart now, dear."
"I seem incapable of love, Father Joe. Utterly incapable of feeling it, even thinking it, even wanting it. No, that's not true. I want to love terribly, but it won't come." "I'm really good at hate. Expert at that. First with Judy, now with Carla. I just don't know what part of me that comes from. Two kinder and more generous souls there couldn't have been, and I'm sure they loved me. Yet I cursed them and hated them and resisted them, not once, but twice, just in case you think the first time was an aberration. That's the way I am. I hate love. It feels the way a sin used to. Like when you got a present as a kid, and for no reason at all you'd smash it into little pieces. And you'd be put somewhere alone, because alone is how the wicked are punished. You said something like that once, didn't you? Hell is being alone for all eternity. Alone, unloved, unloving." I realized my tears were falling on his hand.
God, what a self-pitying fuckhead asshole.
It took me a beat to realize that I hadn't just thought this. I'd said it out loud. He didn't seem to have heard. He was absolutely silent. His face was at rest, eyes still closed, in reception mode.
Tony, dear, you will only be able to love when you understand how much you are loved. You are loved, dear, with a limitless, fathomless, all-embracing love.
He didn't say by God. By whom, then?
Himself?
Like a tidal wave overwhelming the breakwaters of common sense, came the thought that this slowly shrinking, mud-flap-eared old elf of a man was God. Or a body God would from time to time inhabit. But I didn't believe in God. He whispered the words of absolution. I closed my eyes as he formed a cross on my forehead with his thumb, and time rewound to a 14-year-old boy sitting in this same spot, in this same room, being absolved by this same man with the same cross and the same long thumb. With all that I now knew would happen to that boy, unknown. Father Joe replaced his hand on mine, and we sat in silence. His hand was older, the skin slacker, as big and bony as ever, and as warm. I sat there a long time, feeling its peace flow into mine and through my aging frame. I hadn't been to daily offices or mass in years. When I came to Corps, it was usually just for the day. If I stayed overnight, it would be in a hotel. The Abbey Church and the guest house always panicked and depressed me. The echoes of my boyhood still hung in their rafters, the road not taken still stretched beyond the locked door of the cloister. But the most disturbing thing was not how distant all that seemed, but how recent, and as if everything I'd done between then and now was trivial, forgettable, not worth recording. Fleeting is the old word, and it's a great one. Time collapses as it flees. The same night that I went to confession for the first time in 28 years, I decided to attend Compline in toto for the first time in 28 years. I was curious to see how it felt after so long. It was late February, and it had been dark for hours. The church was pitch black except for the tiny red light glowing far away in front of the Blessed Sacrament. The Savior is in. The altar boy's joke. Last time I thought that, I was 12. The bell summoned the community, and in it glided, or flapped and limped. How small it had become. When I last attended offices regularly, there had been 60-odd monks, of all shapes and sizes and ages. Now there were no more than 25, and a preponderance were old and grey and stooped. This place needed recruits. Nothing hit me like the Psalms, gone with the sonorous Latin cadences, replaced by the flat complexities of English. And not the King James' glorious poetry, either. Another, more modern translation, which fell into a very large crack between the mid-19th and late 20th centuries, unable to decide whether it was an early Methodist sermon or dialogue from a soap opera. The chants still sounded Gregorian, but since the melodies had been designed for Latin, there were odd discrepancies with the English. At the end of verses, the nasal New Brit accent of the younger monks sometimes protruded. Not having kept track of the convulsions the church had been going through since Vatican II, all this was new to me. My first thought was that in some obscure ecumenical gesture, the place had gone Protestant for a while. Core was indeed changing. On the whole, I preferred monks packing heat to this travesty. Evidently, the community was still in the bosom of the church. Toward the end, the office reverted to Latin. The final hymn to the Virgin was not the Salve, but that of the season, Ave Regina Caelorum, serene and intense. It soared into the arches, this half-prayer, half-ballad, addressed to the spiritual mother and, who knew, in the secret places of their hearts, the lover, of these quiet men. Something in me came alive, like the glow of a pilot light, a match lit in the distance at dusk. I went outside. I was the only guest staying in the monastery. The entrance area outside the church was empty and unlit, the guest house dark except for my room and the common room. I looked up at the night sky. The wind was sweeping clean. It wasn't an éclat, as once long ago. The universe up there, all around me and within the atom, seemed no less impersonal, no less immeasurable. I listened. The way he'd once said, "Just listen, dear." In the roaring silence was a voice. My voice, it seemed. But then it always does seem to be your own voice. Reconsider what you dismissed so long ago. Reconsider what you've grown accustomed to dismissing without a second thought. That's all you have to do. Rewind to zero and start again. It came less as a revelation, more as something plain and obvious, a thought quietly edging through the door of my mind. The stars shining in the black cupola of the universe could not be there now, any more than I could be here, or the little lump of cooling rock I stood upon, nor any atom it contained, nor the forces that bound them together, were they not maintained in their existence by something. Some fundamental principle or force or thing beneath all other existent principles, forces, and things. Otherwise, there would be nothing. Why not just nothing? Wittgenstein once said, "The mystery is, why does the universe exist at all?" Like many people of my age and milieu, I'd arrived at a vague, emotional rather than reasoned conclusion that the questions of the origin of the universe and therefore of existence had been pretty much settled. The sheer weight of research and discovery, of the various theories postulated, forced questions like "why not just nothing?" to the far horizons of the scientific agenda. I even felt a bit proprietary about all the progress that had been made. The great mind I once sat behind, Stephen Hawking, having been so central to it. I can't have endeared myself to the great mind by making him do my homework, but still, for a moment there, I'd been on his team and he on mine. In light of the inconceivable age and vastness of time and space, and the inconceivable smallness of its quanta, a question like "why not just nothing?" didn't need to be answered, or at least could be postponed. Why matter, energy, time, and space exist, what brought them into existence and maintains them in their existence, are now largely meaningless questions. The universe simply is. The observable fact that matter, energy, time, space, and the forces that govern them exist is all we know, and all we need to know. On the other hand, I did quite enjoy bugging scientifically inclined friends by maintaining that the Big Bang Theory, once you started picking at it, was as loopy as any other creation myth. Example: how did we know that the lump of super-dense matter was the size of a baseball? As confidently asserted by popularizers of the theory, not a golf ball or a watermelon. How exactly did this baseball create within a short time, 3 minutes to be exact, 98% of all the matter contained in our current universe, an entity at minimum trillions of light years across? Or take the issue of time. If the Big Bang occurred, as was generally accepted, 13.7 billion years, or 5,500,000,000 days ago, wasn't that instant an actual moment in time, a specific date? As measurement techniques got more sophisticated, you would soon be able to place the Big Bang on a specific day of the week. How then could you say that before the Big Bang, time did not exist? If there was an after, There was a before. Was the Big Bang Theory really very different from Bishop Usher's 17th century calculation that the creation of the universe began on October the 22nd, 4004 BC, which we all found so hilarious? Say you preferred the more sophisticated notion of the inflationary universe, in which these questions were avoided by calling the baseball a singularity, containing within it not just all matter, but also the space, time, and energy in what would become the universe. If energy did not yet exist, how did it explode? What did it mean that after the initial bang, the singularity spewed space as well as matter through nothingness, so that the material universe would have somewhere to spew through? Didn't creating space in nothingness sound like semantic nonsense? And if there was nowhere before that, where was the singularity the instant before it exploded? When was T equals zero? Zero time. The moment when all this was supposed to take place. Was T equals zero a non-moment that existed before time began? If so, when did time begin? The instant after T equals zero? If so, what started time ticking? Juiciest of all was the response that none of this had to be explained because there had been a previous universe, which had flown apart, just as ours is doing, reached its outer limit, wherever that was, and then somehow collapsed back down to a baseball, or singularity, and started all over again. This explode, expand, contract, explode daisy chain would go on forever, or was continuous, the modern cosmological term for eternal, which sounded ominously familiar. If you stood back from a blind belief in the ability of science to explain everything, these notions started to sound no more plausible than giant snakes arising from the sea to mate with giant elephants, or an inexplicably motivated deity slapping the universe together in a Judeo-Christian work week. Could the reason for the implausibility be that the first person to postulate the Big Bang was Georges Lemaître, a Belgian Catholic priest? But these were just dinner table games. Though the game was exhilarating, I'd always end up feeling grim and sad. The implausibility of the theories was just another blind alley, another non-answer to the agonizing conundrum of why and how we are here. I hated being so close to the questions, to having them even pass through my mind, leaving their fog of depression and despair. Now, gazing up, not at some word in a game, but at a suddenly tangible and real universe, a new idea flooded my brain, with the cool simplicity of water irrigating a drought-stricken field. What if the Big Bang Theory was not a rather loopy theory, but exactly right? The correct account of something that happened a specific, if uncountable, number of days ago, and not only right, but the final horizon of knowledge, beyond which lay the next and only logical conclusion, the intelligence, force, principle that conceived it. What if the super-dense baseball, or the Fabergé egg of singularity, didn't come magically, absurdly out of nowhere, and magically, absurdly happen, but was triggered by an immeasurably ingenious, lucid, and resourceful intelligence? And even if the continuous explode, expand, contract, explode universe was the correct template, and the Big Bang was not a birth but a resurrection, why should that not be purposeful, making absolutely fundamental to existence the dynamic of birth, death, and resurrection? In short, what if this force behind all forces, this light behind all light, this mind behind all matter, existing in time beyond time, was not some obscurantist rubbish, or sublimated primitivism, or desperate clinging to some collective Freudian blankie, but an obvious and inescapable conclusion of all that science had discovered? What if the same were true of the impossibly small, as well as the impossibly large? How fine was it, how limpid and perfect a creative idea, that everything that existed should be based on one infinitesimal building block, the atom. Each of the inconceivable number of atoms in the universe existing for all time, endlessly constituting and reconstituting itself with an inconceivable number of its fellow atoms into everything in the universe, from galaxies to Galileo to me. How glorious was that! That some part of us, some of the atoms in my flesh and blood body, had actually been part of a star, or a stegosaurus, or Dante, or the first fish to crawl on dry land, or, for that matter, the Buddha, or Jesus of Nazareth. That I was, we were, not just spiritually, but actually, factually, one with everything. What if the elusive, grand, unified theory, which every physicist dreamed of, was right in front of me? That force beyond forces, effortlessly uniting the inconceivably immense with the inconceivably minute. This GUT did not nullify 3 centuries of coruscating scientific genius, the staggering revelations made by cosmologists, astrophysicists, quantum theorists, subatomic researchers, those whose Nobel Prizes were nugatory compared to how immeasurably they deepened our understanding of the universe and all that's in it. How beautiful, how simple, how vast, how small, how awe-inspiring and superbly conceived. No, their work and all that remained to be done would be ineffably fulfilled. Perhaps, why not just nothing, was a question science could not answer. It could only prepare one to answer it. Why not just nothing was above and beyond the random uncertainties of the material. A question that could be posed and be understood only by those who study and calibrate that unique aspect of the human mind, the ability to consider its own existence. A question that can be answered only by a poet, or a saint. I had no idea what this force or principle that suddenly seemed so real and present was, whether it had a presence in the sense of a person, or in the sense of a truth present in the universe. It was obviously what people meant when they said God, but no formulation of God I'd ever heard, in terms of person, parent, or gender, had made sense to me, even as a metaphor. I felt no love for, or from, this force or principle. I made no connection between it and what I'd witnessed going on inside the church, beautiful or moving or spiritual though that might have been. Father Joe would connect it for me somehow. Sometime. I had utter confidence in his ability to do that. This was his field of study, and he was a world-class scholar. But that could wait till tomorrow. Right now, I thought, the God-force-principle thing would like me to pop down to the pub and celebrate. Which I did. Chapter 17. Father Joe didn't think of it as his doing. He was not a cheerleader. Success and failure were not in his lexicon. They imply an end point, and he'd always been more interested in a process of eliminating the self, of finding the principle or force which he called God, loving it, listening to it, a process that had no end point, nor any point at which it could be measured, and success or failure declared. He was happy beyond telling that I might be started back down the path of faith. But it had been mine to find, and now that I could see a possible way, not much more than a deer track, but still a way, through the undergrowth, he took no credit, though I showered him with it. He only gave thanks. I would never be a checkmark in some spiritual scorebook. I had known this man now for 33 years, more than half his career as a monk. In a few weeks, it would be his 60th anniversary. 60 years, that is, since his profession in 1928, at the age of 19, writing out his solemn vows of stability, obedience, and conversion of life on a sheet of parchment, and depositing it on the altar. St. Benedict's first and shrewdest rule, put it in writing. With the exception of the Great War, which he was too young to be aware of, He had bypassed just about everything in this terrible, grasping, murderous century. Where did he spend the Depression? In poverty. Where did he spend World War II? At peace. Where had he spent the Cold War, with its bloody capitalist tyrants and bloody communist revolutions? Loving his enemies. Even now, that absurd conflict was winding down, thanks to men of peace like John Paul II and Mikhail Gorbachev. Thanks to the stubborn populations of Europe, my contemporaries and their parents, who, for all their manifest mindlessness and endless tribal squabbles, had remained a generation of peace, refusing to buy Reagan's fatuous cartoon of the Russian people or be cowed by his cowardly weapons of mass murder. After all the terror and threats and nightmare scenarios and brinkmanship, the most pointless and dangerous face-off in the planet's history was being ended without a single shot. Pax, that simple, timeless word that was at the heart of the Benedictine tradition, that had endured through all of Europe's travails and convulsions, from Charlemagne to Churchill, had won the Cold War. The spirit of Father Joe was coming out on top in the worst century in human memory. Perhaps his faith in the force of prayer was not so far-fetched. I had sometimes wondered, a common pastime of my generation, what would have happened if the Nazis had succeeded in overrunning England. They certainly would have swept away Corps, and Father Joe with it. The Nazis exterminated Catholics, Catholic clergy in particular, as efficiently as any of their other victims. But the Benedictines would have gone on. Other Father Joes would have arisen from the River of Black to build other corps. Down the centuries, other Nazis had overrun other nations. Monks had been slaughtered and monasteries burned for the very act of refusing to fight, for sheltering the helpless, for meeting hate with love. Those mighty empires, and the greed and violence and hatred that are the lifeblood of any empire, had all passed like grass before the wind. Where were the Visigoths and Vikings, the Golden Hordes, the Spaniards, the Venetians, the Mughals, the invincible British Empire on which the sun never set and never would? Where were those great peoples upon whose works the mighty looked and despaired, and whose names even scholars now had trouble remembering? The Abbasids, the Franks, the Lombards, the Saracens, the Magyars, the Ottomans. All gone. And here was Father Joe, mighty in his meekness, still surviving and thriving after 1,500 years of other Father Joes. Over the years, my focus on my old friend, on not losing sight of him however much I lost my way, had shouldered out my once intense feeling for the great tradition in which Corps had its place. In my apostasy, or atheism, or more honestly, plain indifference to the divine, he had remained an exceptional human being, whose wisdom and quiet charisma transcended the religious and monastic terms in which it was couched. But Corps I had put aside. Now, like someone rummaging in the attic and coming upon long-forgotten treasures, I began to recall how deeply excited I'd been by the discovery of changelessness, that some institutions did not pass like grass before the wind, but endured, acquiring a profoundly thrilling aura by their very refusal to succumb to the never-ending pressure for change. By the related discovery that history was not simply a catalogue of the dead and buried and benighted, but rather a vast new world to be pioneered. That if you approached the past generously, so to speak, its people as humans, not facts, as modern in their time as we were in ours, who thought and felt as we do, the dead would live again, our equals, not our old-fashioned, hopelessly unenlightened and backward inferiors. Humanity, to be fully known, had to be seen as changeless as well as ever-changing. Corps and the Benedictine tradition had been my gateway to these discoveries, a specific living example I was part of and which made history vibrate with life. In the days that followed, I read as much as I could about what had happened to my church while I'd been away. It was pretty bad. The mighty chain of events and people, stretching back over almost 2,000 years, which even a pimply teenager like me had once thrilled to, had been not just shattered, but thrown on the garbage heap. As if only certain links in it mattered, the church's official lapses and sins, not the hundreds of millions of other links, kind and generous people, clergy and laity, hard striving souls, full of faith and good works and humor, and of failure and frustration and sin and tribulation. These had been the church also for 2,000 years. But they appeared to be without merit for our doughty reformers, nothing but a millennium-long death dance of superstition and gullibility. As far as I could tell, the reformers who had taken charge after Vatican II, mostly my contemporaries or slightly older, had indulged enthusiastically in one of our generation's most deadly flaws, nurtured, no doubt, by growing up in the rubble of World War II, a willful lack of any sense of history. I'd been doing no reforming, but I was not without blame. Like my contemporaries, I'd for years bought into an attitude that went well beyond Henry Ford's reprehensible "history is bunk." In our version, history was far worse than bunk. It was suspect, the enemy, invariably evil, a repository of constant failure and deadly delusions and appalling role models. History was when all the mistakes were made, all the atrocities committed, that time before we knew better. History was before we were born again to the one true faith. Only change, with its benison of the new and the now, can lead to salvation. There was an object lesson here that went beyond the chaotic state of the church. To reject any vast group of one's cultural ancestors in the cause of some current theory is not just arrogance, it's posthumous mass murder. It's the same kind of thinking that makes genocide possible. The masses, albeit the dead masses, and the pathetic little lives they lived, are irrelevant compared to this greater purpose we have at hand. Write them out of the record. They never existed. One very concrete result of these reforms could be seen in the choir stalls of the Core Abbey Church. If you brought the next generation up to despise history, especially the history of their own church, pretty soon you'd have only one-third the monks, the old farts or young kooks who liked singing unhummable thousand-year-old chants and following an unempowering, self-negating 1,500-year-old rule. Core was not changing. It was being changed. Why? What on earth had been wrong with it? A more serious question: if it was shrinking at this rate, could it survive? I mentioned my misgivings to Father Joe. He was less concerned about what looked to me like wreckage.
"People are always changing themselves and their world, dear. Very few of the changes are new. We rather confuse change and newness, I think. What is truly new never changes."
"You speak in riddles, aged progenitor."
The world worships a certain kind of newness. People are always talking about a new car, or a new drink, or play, or house. But those things are not truly new, are they? They begin to get old the minute you acquire them. New is not in things. New is within us. The truly new is something that is new forever. You. Every morning of your life, and every evening, every moment is new. You have never lived this moment before, and you never will again. In this sense, the new is also the eternal."
"Unless change generated newness of this sort," he went on, "it was pointless change, undertaken simply for the sake of change. That did not mean that every so often it wasn't necessary to clear away bad habits, dead wood, and outdated customs, to adapt to new information. That was necessary to return the church to its essentials. That, in turn, did not mean fundamentalism, the recurrent urge of all reformers to sweep away everything and return to the way it had been in the beginning. in the Vatican II reformer's case, the early church. Wisdom and genius and sanctity, undreamed of by the early church, had been acquired along the way since then. It had to be preserved too. It was the oaks that drove his point home. The autumn before, in 1987, terrible storms had invaded England and Western Europe, sweeping in from the Atlantic and devastating, among much else, its magnificent forests. The great oak woods of Cor now looked as if they'd been carpet-bombed. The mighty trees had toppled one on the other into a gigantic rat's nest of gnarled and tortured timber. The choppy grey sea could be seen everywhere through the tangled web woven by their dead branches. The proud skyline of the woods, the billowing shapes of the trees which used to form a majestic grey-green cloud bank in summer, an immense rude screen of exquisitely delicate tracery in winter, was gone forever. But what was forever? Oaks had been here 8 centuries ago, when Cor Abbey was down the hill. Some might be the grandchildren of trees that had been growing in much the same places then. The children and grandchildren of these, standing tall amid the carnage, would spawn and propagate. Cor's oaks would still be here, as sturdy, safe, and reassuring, long after I was gone, after all the sad and violent and stupid and laughable experiments of the 20th century were not even footnotes. Those were the fallen trees, the ones whose roots were not deep enough, or were deep in treacherous soil. One could not judge things by the brief span of one's own lifetime. That was at the core of modern arrogance. Only my lifetime counts. My lifetime is forever. Time before it and time after it do not exist. Everything of importance must come to pass in my lifetime. This is what drives the frenzy for change. And that's really how the idea started. The idea was at first mostly practical. I could do something to stop this rot of newness. Just one person I might be, but you had to start somewhere. Which is why Father Joe and I came to be walking along the edge of the devastated woods. I was chatting about how I was getting back into the rhythm of the offices, despite how disturbed and repelled I was by the new forms, telling him that some faint whiff of faith was beginning to seep back into my soul. I could hardly say that my belief in every Catholic doctrine had returned. Many of the old doctrines seemed to have disappeared anyway, making the sanctity aptitude test rather easier. But that wasn't what I wanted to talk to him about this morning. The idea had grown into a certainty in the week or so after it first came to me. The more I looked back on my life and behavior over the last 25 years, the more it seemed to be what I had always been avoiding. The nose-on-my-face obviousness of it now ridiculously clear. The idea also made sense of the time that remained to me. Because it had always lived within me, in profundis, I had held back through both my marriages. What had lain in our marriage bed had not been an unholy spirit, a yago. On the contrary, it had not been evil or murderous at all. My idea could not have occurred to me before, but now I had reached the culminating point of my life, the moment of decision to which I had been heading all along. I could stop running. Escape was not the answer. At a particularly appropriate point, on the edge of the derelict woods, with a magnificent view up over the bosom of the field to the pink and yellow mass of the monastery, I stopped. It was very early spring, hard and blue and chilly. I wanted to remember this moment, and I wanted him to as well. I turned the rounded old shoulders toward me. He was quite a bit shorter than I now, squinting up at me, a twitching smile on his lips, relishing my air of mystery, the surprise I had planned for him. "Dear Father Joe, I've thought about this long and hard. It's why I'm here, and why I'm being led back to faith. And, well, there are 100 reasons we can go into later. I'm 26 years late, dear Father Joe, but I've never been known for punctuality. I wish to present myself once more as a postulant to the community of Core Abbey. This time, I'm ready. Over the last week, I had seen it in my mind's eye 100 times. The old face turning in surprise, creasing bright with joy after all these years. After so much sin and apostasy, the lost sheep is found. The prodigal returns. The father embraces his long-lost son and gives thanks to the Lord. And there is great rejoicing in that house. What I actually saw was an old man suddenly look very weary. He sank down on a huge, newly cut oak stump and patted the stump. I sat down beside him.
Dear Tony, we've known one another so long. You have been such a joy in my life.
Every crease of his face radiated tenderness. For once it was at rest, rapt, serious. His sharp old eyes searched mine. He was silent for a while.
You know, dear...
He paused a long moment and sighed.
Almost from the first moment I set eyes on you, I knew you would never make a monk.
Never in my life had a few little words hit me with such force. I had to gasp for breath.
Often I resisted this knowledge. I would think, perhaps I'm wrong. You never know. One must be humble. And you were so dedicated, even after your terrible vision of hell, so certain of your vocation. I was confused.
Father Joe was gazing at the ground, hands clasped as if he were in confession and searching his conscience.
Sometimes I tried to push you away. Sometimes, through my selfishness, I encouraged you to persevere. Because I love you, dear, and always have, and wanted you very much to become a monk here. That's why I kept you in the guest house all those weeks, Tony, dear. I could not bring myself to present you as a postulant. Although I wanted to, oh yes. That was what I wanted, you see. That was not what God wanted.
I wasn't listening. His self-examination had given me a moment to regroup. Father Joe, wait. Is this because of my marriage? My marriage is...
No. There is no canonical barrier to your entering Core. The Church recognizes neither of your marriages.
So then, surely it's not your decision. It's mine. His eyes had moistened. I realized that I had never seen this profoundly emotional man with tears in his eyes.
The evening your father called for you to go to Cambridge, Tony, well, God seemed hard that night, but it was for the best. I knew then that we would not see you after university.
I should have come back. That's where I went wrong.
If you had come back to us, dear, sooner or later, you would have exploded.
A smile creased the old mouth,
causing considerable damage to bystanders.
Father Joe, that person was immature, confused, deluded, unreliable, faithless. I've made a new beginning.
I know, dear, and it will grow and mature and blossom, but not here.
You're wrong this time. You were right long ago about being wrong. This has been part of me forever. It's why my marriages didn't work. Why I destroyed the lives of those around me. Even at my least spiritual times, it was still there. A hard little spur of truth. I belong here. Core is my home. These words seemed to strike deep. He looked totally exhausted. He shook his head imperceptibly.
That little spur is not a monastic vocation, dear. It's your refusal to accept your true vocation.
Which is what?
You're a husband and a father, Tony. I could see that long ago. The way you thought of Lily and treated her, even as a boy, gently and generously. A husband and father is what God has always wanted you to be. It's a vocation as sacred as ours.
I've failed utterly at both those things, Father Joe. Not once, twice.
Yes, yes, you fought God. One could even say that the first time you won. But boundless love, Tony dear, is giving you a second chance.
Father Joe, dear Father Joe, please, don't do this. In reply, he took my face in his old hands, and as he had in the first moment I ever saw him, gave me the kiss of peace. Carla was cautious. If she was curious, she kept it well hidden. I fed her curiosity with my reticence about what had happened. That scalpel-sharp intuition must have led her to conclude that it had been big, and that it was best for now to leave well alone. Had I accepted Father Joe's verdict? Not by any means. I'd rushed away, leaving the old man desolate on his oak stump. It didn't occur to me until much later that it must have been just as hard for him, that he'd probably hoped he would never have to say those words, that I would never put him in the position where he'd have to confess what he really felt, and that, for him as for me, this moment had the same aching finality, the same mournful what might have been. At his venerable age it would have been easy enough, if he really thought he'd get pleasure and comfort from having me around, just to suppress his true feelings and welcome me with open arms. Instead, as ever, he'd taken a deeply unselfish course, rejecting the easy thing, steering me away from a life he felt deeply was wrong for me, would damage me in some way, however much I wanted it, a mistake he would not let me repeat. That understanding came later, when my anger and anguish had gone. My immediate impulse, for the only time in all the years I'd known him, was to go behind his back. He was wrong. I knew it. His judgment was impaired. Perhaps it was the chemo. Corps was desperate for recruits, even if they were 47 years old. I was needed. I was called. In any case, he wasn't the final authority. Not at all. He'd been relieved of his authority, as a matter of fact. The go-to guy, whom I should have approached in the first place, was my old friend Dom Aylred, now and for many years the abbot, the big dog in the cloister, whose word was absolute law. The abbot couldn't see me for 2 days, which meant I had to live in a stew of uncertainty for 48 hours, but for a